Welcome to Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. I'm your host, Nick Hershon, guiding you through our own drafts of history. This episode is sponsored by Northwest U, a faith-based U.S. News & World Report best value university located near Seattle, Washington. Founded in 1934, it offers more than 70 majors and academic programs as a university of possibility. She interviewed Fidel Castro, covered the Nuremberg trials, and moderated a presidential debate. Pauline Frederick soared through the glass ceiling of the television news industry, enjoying a nearly 50-year career at ABC and NBC that saw her become the first woman to serve as a network news correspondent. In this episode, we discuss Frederick's career with Marilyn Greenwald of Ohio University, the author of the book, Pauline Frederick Reporting. We also discuss the art of biography writing more broadly, including how to find a suitable subject, how to research using archives and oral history interviews, and how to choose the right design for a book jacket. All right, Dr. Greenwald, welcome to the Journalism History Podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we're here today to talk about your most recent book, Pauline Frederick Reporting, A Pioneering Broadcaster Covers the Cold War. And it was published in 2014 by Potomac Books, an imprint of the University of Nebraska Press. And you've written several biographies now, Charlotte Curtis, a former society editor at the New York Times, and Leslie McFarlane, the newspaper reporter who created the characters of Joe and Frank Hardy, better known as the Hardy Boys, two of the most famous amateur detectives in children's literature. And you also teach a biography writing course at Ohio University, which I was fortunate enough to take a few years ago. So before we get into Pauline Frederick specifically, I want you to start out by asking you, what do you think makes a good subject for a biography?
Boy, you see, in my mind, somebody who's overlooked but really interesting makes a good subject. And we know we talk in our class, as you might remember, about, you know, people who are interesting but who have been written about a lot. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I get really excited when I find somebody who maybe isn't famous per se, but what they've done is so fascinating and they're just such an interesting person. So, you know, that's really what draws me. That's what has drawn me to the subjects, you know, that I've written about. This idea of, I can't believe that most people don't know about this person or what she did.
Are you thinking at all about marketability, whether this sort of book will sell, or is it more just you're interested enough and you hope that passion will somehow translate into sales?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I'm not interested per se in a lot of sales, but to get it published, of course, you've got to make the case that it will sell, you know. And I'm not saying I don't want anyone to read it, but I'm not thinking if this doesn't sell a million, I'm going to be upset. You know, I mean, I'm not like that. I want people to read it. But just from a practical point of view, you have to make the case to any publisher that the book's going to sell. I mean, obviously, nonprofit publishers, they're not looking for books to sell a million per se, but they still want, you know, they don't want to lose money. So it's a little bit of both. I'm not in it per se to be a best-selling author, but I do want people to read the book, you know, so for my own personal reasons and so I could get a publisher.
So we're going to start by talking about Pauline Frederick. And can you please tell us who Pauline Frederick was and then how you came to research her life?
Yeah, in a nutshell, she was the first full-time female network correspondent. So she was around in kind of in her heyday, I would say, where she was essentially a household name, was in the 60s, maybe early 70s. And she really was a household name. She worked for NBC. She was not exactly a regular on Meet the Press, but she was on Meet the Press a lot. Her segments were on the Today Show, you know, just as a network correspondent, you know, would be today. And she covered the United Nations in a lot of international news, although she was, you know, based in this country, in New York. And how I got interested in her, a colleague of mine, Joe Burnt at OU, we did research together and, you know, we're friends, and he happened to find a Saturday Evening Post story about her. believe it was from, it was in the early 60s. I don't remember the date. And it was a huge story. And if you remember the Saturday Evening Post, they did these wonderful big stories with all kinds of pictures. And you could, and it was by Gay Talese. I mean, so they put, you know, one of their, you know, solid reporters on it, or some, or a freelancer who everybody knew. And you could tell from reading it that she was virtually a household name. I mean, everybody, you know, knew who she was. You could just tell by the tone of the article. And Joe, being Joe, he didn't just say, oh, this is interesting, you know, she might make a book. He actually did a little bit of research and said, you know, she's got papers. She's got, you know, papers over at Smith College, and it looks like it's a pretty extensive collection. So that's when I started looking into her, because unfortunately, as you probably know, there's a lot of really interesting people out there, people you want to write about, but they either don't have papers, or you can't have access to them, or the only way you'll get information really is maybe from interviews, maybe. And it's just, what might seem exciting at the beginning, you kind of lose your enthusiasm when you think there's just not that much about this person, you know, other than to turn it into a big personality profile. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, but yeah.
How much does that affect your process if you find out that maybe you're very interested in a certain subject, but if Pauline had not had an archive, or if it was maybe spread out across multiple archives, you could have certainly, I guess, cobbled something together just from clips of her that are out there and newspaper articles, but you really wanted access to her own papers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends. You know, somebody doesn't have to have the volume of papers that she did. And, you know, she, if you look at her era, she was, you can do the math, she was born in 1908. So, you know, there were people around who knew her, but they were getting up there. And her main living relative was a niece who I would say was in her 70s at the time. You, it just depends. Now, she worked at NBC for decades. So, you know, you also have, as you kind of implied, you know, there's footage because she's a broadcaster, you know, television person. And you also have the archives of the network, which, you know, anybody can imagine are huge, you know. So it would make it a little harder. You'd have to determine, is there enough here outside of just having a great archive? That's a decision you'd have to make. I will tell you, of the other people that I've written about, I don't want to say easiest, but her archive was not only the biggest, it was the organized incredibly well, you know. So in that way, it was the most accessible of anybody that I wrote about. And some of the other people, at least Leslie McFarlane, who wrote the Hardy Boys books, he didn't have an archive per se, but I managed to get, by the time I got information from his family and from other sources, I think that worked out, you know. But this was, I have to tell you, this was a gold mine. I mean, it just was. I was very lucky, and I could not believe that somebody hadn't done a full-length book on her, you know.
Well, I was just going to ask about that, because it seems like all of the materials were there for a biographer to find. And she obviously had a high profile. She was a notable journalist working for nearly 50 years for major news outlets like ABC and NBC. And she's somewhat forgotten. And as I was researching before our interview today, I noticed the Wikipedia page for Pauline Frederick actually directs not to the journalist, but to an American stage and film actress in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And then says, if you want, you can go to the Pauline Frederick journalist page. So why do you think that even though she has this archive, even though she had such a high stature at the time, she was sort of lost to history?
You know, that's a good question. One reason, and this, I don't know if this explains it, she was pretty low-key and self-effacing. She was not a self-promoter. That wasn't her personality. And, you know, Barbara Walters came on the scene a little bit after she did. And so I was reading a little about Barbara, you know, and Barbara was, and I don't mean this in a negative way, she was a huge self-promoter. I mean, and I'm not saying we wouldn't have heard of Barbara Walters, but I mean, they were total opposites. Barbara, right from the start, you know, she knew how to promote herself, how to get attention. And with Pauline, I think it was mostly about the work, you know, and that, and getting it right, and being respected. And so I think if she had been a little bit more of a promoter of her own work, that might have helped, you know. But her with her stature, particularly with the network, you know, and then there were only three networks, of course, you know, back then. It is pretty amazing that nobody had done more on her.
So then getting more into your process, because I know this is something that you discuss with your students in the biography class at Ohio University. How do you start out once you find that there's an archive? What is your initial step if you've decided this is the person you want to write a biography about?
Well, you know, of course, as we discussed, you know, in the class, you really spend a lot of time in the archive to see what's there, you know. You also, I think you have to find out what else is available. I mean, this to me was all in one place, but the NBC, I really looked at the NBC, the history of NBC archives, and saw what was there. And see what that does, looking outside of the person, is get you an idea of the era, you know. So I learned, and I kid because I'm a print person, and just about everybody I've written about has been a print person, and she was a broadcaster, although started out in print. But anyway, but you look at the era, and I was learning some really fascinating things about network television back when she was starting out. I mean, and I found it really interesting, even little things like the 6:30 newscast used to be 15 minutes. It was a big deal when it went to a half hour, and this was during her era, things like that. So, you know, and I guess I found that interesting. And I'm not saying, well, that era was pretty boring. You know, I mean, you're not going to think that, but this was a real key area, era in media, you know, it really was. So, and then this was the time when television was, you know, people were turning to television and everybody was saying radio was going to go under. It's kind of like what's happening now, you know, or happened with online and print. So there were a lot of parallels to what's going on today. The era was really fascinating. And of course, the NBC archive, just, you know, at the Library of Congress, part of it's at the Library of Congress and part of it's in Wisconsin. But the part I used was the Library of Congress. That's, you know, the Library of Congress, if you know what you're doing, it's relatively easy to use. So it's that what's going on around the person too. If you have to find that interesting, you have to know a little bit about it. I didn't know about broadcasting, but I knew of course about media, you know? So that's, you know, I kid in my class, somebody once said to me, well, you should do a book on people well-known. And he was serious. He goes, well, like the Wright brothers, for instance. And I was looking at him, I said, I know absolutely nothing about aviation. You know what I mean? And I guess you want to know something about the person. You don't have to be an expert. But that to me, it was a bridge too far. I really know nothing about the history of aviation. So know a little bit about the topic in general outside of the person and have an interest in it.
Right. And obviously you're trying to fit it into your mass communication research agenda.
Yeah.
That's your own knowledge base and just the community of scholars that you work with.
Right. Right.
At what point in that process then, you talked about going to the archives, do you decide you're going to reach out to people maybe who Pauline knew in life or people who were influenced by her? Because I know that you also make use of interviews sometimes or maybe materials that aren't in an archive, but somebody has kept in a basement or an attic for years. At what point do you start reaching out to the Pauline Frederick family, for example?
Yeah, well, you want to do it as soon as possible, but there's a disclaimer to that. You want to do it as soon as possible because, you know, in the people I've done and, you know, they're getting up there. They're older, particularly that niece that I mentioned. So you know, you want to be practical and do it quickly. But, you know, as you're implying, you're not just going to, you know, spend 20 minutes looking at her history and then call them up. Right. Because you're not going to know anything about her. So you've got to have a happy medium where you really become acquainted with her. And I definitely went to the archive before I called the niece, before I contacted the niece. In fact, I tried to know her as well as I could before I called the niece, because obviously they know you're serious. You know, I mean, once you start talking about them and you know their life, so that gets you ahead. And also you don't want to be, you know, calling the person back a million times. Oh, I just found this out about her. I'm calling you back. And oh, I just found this out. And there's nothing wrong with, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with, you know, contacting a person again, but ideally, you know, you want to know you most of your questions you want to have in mind and ask them. So you have to decide when am I happy with what I know about her? I know enough about her to contact the people, you know, that I'm calling. I talked to a couple people, and they were older too, at former NBC correspondents. And that was another thing I wanted to know about the network and the history of the network and what was going on before I call former network correspondents. Oh, I know nothing about NBC. You know, I don't want to indicate that. So you do as much as you can, but then you don't, you know, if you wait too long, you know, who knows, the person's not going to be around.
Right. And you're pretty prolific with your writing. So do you have strict deadlines for yourself? Like, I'm going to do the archival stage for 2 months, 3 months, and then I'm going to move on definitively to oral history interviews. And then that's only a 2 or 3 month stage before I move on to the actual writing. Or are these all kind of taking place at once?
I have very loose deadlines. I mean, and I very rarely write when I'm in the middle of the research. I just don't, because I got to get a momentum going. They're very loose deadlines. And as you know, in our lives, when we teach, when we're not teaching in the summer, you know, in December, when we have a lot of time, I take that into consideration, you know, so I know, well, I have all of December. And obviously there's the summer. So they're very loose deadlines, but they're deadlines nonetheless. One thing you have to do, and I think it's a trap you can fall into, you've got to keep moving. I mean, you have to keep moving. When I was writing the Pauline book, I went to China for 3 weeks, and that was the longest I'd been gone from writing the book. I had most of the research done, 90% of it, 95%, and I was doing the writing, and I thought, well, no big deal. You know, it's 3 weeks. It set me back. I mean, I have to say, it set me back. So don't think, well, I'm going to take 2 weeks off. Or unless you absolutely have to, at least with me, you know, I need that momentum. I really do. When I lose that momentum, I'm dead. It's hard for me. I backtrack is what happens. And then I get mad at myself because I'm backtracking, and that's not good. So momentum is the thing with me. I've got to keep doing it. And with to some degree with the research, obviously you can't continue research, you know, 7 days a week, but you've got to genuinely keep doing it. Oh, I'm putting this project down for 6 months and then I'm coming back to it. I think that would be really hard. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to do it, but I wouldn't do it unless you absolutely have to.
Sure. Well, then another thing that's part of that process is what stage you decide I'm going to start looking for publishers, or do I maybe pull out a section of this potential book to be a conference paper or a journal article? So at what point in your process are you starting to think about outlets?
You can think about, you know, conference papers I've done pretty much, you can do those early on because they're so short. The publishing aspect, I try to get a publisher as soon as I can, because for a number of reasons, you know, mentally you want to think, well, I'm not doing this for my health or just for a conference paper. You know, you want to think, I'm putting this time in for a book. Plus, you know, sometimes depending on who you interview, they'll ask, well, who's your publisher? And, you know, even if you don't have one, it's not the end of the world, but you get that. So if I have a really good subject, I generally can fashion a pretty good book proposal. I think I've gotten that down, you know. So I try to get the publisher pretty early. I find it discouraging, you know, to be writing 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chapters and you don't have a publisher. I mean, you know, publishers do want sample chapters, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. But I don't like, you know, doing a lot without a publisher, you know. And in your first book, I think you have to. I mean, I have the luxury of, you know, most of the publishers I've gotten, they've only required a sample chapter or two because I've had other books. I think if it's your first book, you do have to get to a point where I may be writing most of this book without a publisher because it would be your first one.
And when you're talking about selling to a publisher, one of the themes I remember coming up in our biography class was how much do you maybe exaggerate or overhype the tendency to try to want to sell to a publisher this person? And so you want to be accurate, of course, as a biographer. But then we know that the biographies that sometimes sell are more about scandal and sex and bizarre things that are happening in people's lives. So how did you do that with someone like Pauline Frederick? Because it seems like she didn't necessarily have crazy events happening to her, although she was a very well-known person in her day and was certainly worthy of scholarship.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, you know, there's a difference between, you know, something, you know, making something salacious when it's not, you know, something like that. Or I remember when I was trying to sell the Charlotte Curtis book, the New York Times editor, somebody asked, well, did she have affairs with anybody famous? I'll never forget that. You know, so you're not going to go, well, you know, oh, she happened to talk to somebody once and I'm going to have her having an affair with him. You know, I'm not going to do that. I think, you know, so there's a difference between that. But I think you can, I don't want to say hype, but or exaggerate, but you, a lot of times, you know what a publisher will like. You hope that it'll lead to that. So you can kind of exaggerate it a little bit. And publishers, editors know that things don't always turn out the way they planned. I mean, I think most editors are sophisticated enough to know if you say something and it sounds really, really super exciting and it doesn't pan out, that's fine. But in the bigger picture, you have to have an interesting person. I don't know how you can hype something, someone who's not at their core compelling. You know, well, I hyped her so much and she's really pretty boring. And now I have this book contract. I mean, I don't think it could work out unless you just want to lie. I mean, unless you're ready. But, you know, and not to get off the subject, but Kitty Kelly, who's a pretty famous biographer, you know, I think sometimes, and she does, you know, very famous people, Nancy Reagan, you know, I think she did Frank Sinatra, you know, but I think she at one point had a reputation for hyping things, and you know, so that's a whole different realm. You know, I have no problem with. I might exaggerate this a little bit, and it might be the truth. I don't know. I have no problem with that. But the core of it, you have to have an interesting person, a compelling person, and ideally in a compelling era. You know, and don't underestimate. I'm not saying you are, but you know, don't underestimate that editors know that what's in your proposal is going to be 100% of what you have in the book. You know, that's not going to happen, and they know that.
Sure. Well, to that point then, while you were researching the life of Pauline Frederick, did you find anything that was surprising? Not necessarily salacious, but just anything that had not been in the scholarship before and you were able to make that new contribution?
I found a ton. I mean, this is what's so exciting. You know, sometimes if somebody is unknown, you kind of go into it thinking, am I going to have enough here? You know, oh, is this going to be interesting enough? Because she's unknown. And the books I've written, I've worried a tiny bit about that. And it's always been quite the opposite, you know, where, oh, my God, this happened. Oh, this happened and this happened. Oh, my God, that's not even in the proposal. You know, I didn't even know that. So yeah, it's actually been the, I mean, and again, nothing per se racy, but I mean, just from a historical point of view, you know, even, and I, you know, a lot of things in Pauline, I remember, you know, Lyndon Johnson was complaining about a story that she had done and he was furious and he called, you know, president of NBC, and then the LBJ library happened to have that call. They had a transcript of it and they also had the tape. I mean, that's exciting, you know, because you find out about it and like, wow, that would be nice to hear LBJ yell at, you know, the president of NBC. Well, there it is, you know, there he is yelling at the president of NBC. So things like that, you know, get you excited. And there's just a lot of stuff like that I found in her story.
Any tips for people who are doing biographical research? Obviously, you teach this course, and maybe in a nutshell, are there any some of your secrets of how to find information or convey it that maybe you didn't know when you first set out writing these books?
Well, depending on what you're doing, of course, but the presidential libraries are a gold mine, you know, and they're not just for people who do books, articles on presidents. I mean, look at this. I used it for Pauline. In fact, Nixon Library too. So, I guess that's a goldmine. And depending on what you're doing, and we talked about this in class, oral histories. The United Nations has this enormous oral history, hours and hours of tapes of Pauline. And you know, a lot of times people I don't want to say they'll reveal secrets, but they'll say stuff in oral histories, particularly like an oral history that they know isn't going to be broadcast to the world. They'll say things and you're like, wow, or they'll admit things. Because I don't know, maybe subconsciously they think, well, this is a United Nations oral history. Who on earth is ever going to, you know, listen to this, as opposed to being interviewed by Lester Holt on NBC, you know, then you're going to be a little more guarded. So, these oral histories that are on these sites like the United Nations, that, you know, NBC, you know, the networks and the presidential libraries, you know, I feel bad about the presidential libraries because I don't know how many people use those in a year. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot, but comparatively when you think of what they have there and the money put into those, because they're absolutely fascinating. And if you dig deep into the website, like I said, I found this tape of LBJ, I mean, it didn't even take me that long. It was so well organized, you know, and I never went over there. I mean, I got that from my home on my computer. So, and then I guess my other quick tip is, and we talked about this in class, there's so much online now, you know. I mean, when I did the Charlotte Curtis book back in the mid 90s, when I think now what's online and there, I mean, the internet was around, but no, nothing like it is now. And these archives were—they didn't. You couldn't get much, you know, from your computer. You had to go place. When, you know, that Smith College did its own little online display of Pauline Frederick. So they had excerpts from letters, and they had pictures on a certain theme. I mean, they didn't just throw them up on the website. You know, there was a theme. There were themes. So. Never underestimate what's available online and at these, you know, government-funded repositories.
I'd like to move on to some sort of tips you might have after the book is finished and you're starting to actually start with promotion and dealing with the publisher. So pulling back on the curtain on some of these parts of the book process that we don't discuss much, one aspect of that is working with the publisher to create an eye-catching cover, and it's a conversation that we've had a lot lately because I have my own book coming out that I was talking about. So the cover for your book on Pauline shows her sitting at a desk with some papers in her hands as she's broadcasting for ABC Radio in the late 1940s, and it has this wonderful old-style microphone there, so it very quickly conveys that she is a reporter of some sort, a broadcaster. It puts her in the age. It's a black-and-white image. And you got this from the digital archives at Smith College, which you mentioned you use for your research. So more generally, what do you think makes a good cover? And then if you can tell us at all about the Pauline cover specifically, how did you find it? How did you come to that decision?
Okay. What makes a good cover? I'm bad at that. All right. I mean, if you show me something and I think it will make a good cover. I know, you know, I know a good cover when I see it, that kind of thing. But I'm bad about thinking, well, so maybe the cover should have this or look like this or do this. If you show me something and, you know, it's like if you buy clothes, you put on something, it's like, yes, that's good. That fits just right. Or you put on something, this doesn't look good. You know, so I'm okay. If I see something, I can say that'll make a good cover or it won't. And that's what happened with Pauline. There were a million, and that's not much of an exaggeration. There were probably a couple hundred photos of her in the archive at Smith. This one was online, you're right, but there were also other photos. So rule number one, go into it thinking about the cover. I mean, I got a book contract in February for a book that's due in a couple months, and as soon as I signed the contract, the letter from the publisher said, start thinking about photos, you know? I mean, so there you go. So I'm already thinking about the cover. So do that. And, you know, even if you're not using a website heavily about that person, access it anyway, because there could be photos, you know, about the era, or maybe not with that person in it, but about that era. I guess tip number one, be thinking about photos/cover from the start, from the absolute start. And have it in your brain. And then, you know, when you have a, you know, sometimes when I have an extra 20 minutes and I'm sitting around and I don't want to write, you know, I can't start writing or doing much in 20 minutes, I'll peruse websites and say, hey, maybe I can find a photo here. Or let me think of possible photos, because we all love photos, right? I mean, you know, a lot of people, I'm in the bookstore. First thing I do, I pick up the book and I go to the photos. And we've had the conversation, as you noted, that covers are so important, and they draw people, and how do you get them, and they're difficult, and et cetera, et cetera. So just think about the cover right from the start, because if you do it when you're done or halfway done, it's not going to work. I mean, maybe it will. I was lucky with Pauline because, you know, this was one of the photos available. It was perfect. It was a publicity shot of hers, you know. But it's not always that easy.
Right. I might add to that too, the price of the photos that you are using, because I've found, and I'm sure this was with your research, if you were to go to ABC or NBC or any news agency that might have had photographs, even going to the New York Times for Charlotte Curtis, for example, they might be charging a lot more than a traditional archive at Smith College or a library that tend to have much more reasonable fees and are more used to dealing with academic authors. So I don't know if you had tried to use ABC, NBC before you went to Smith, but that probably would save you some money too.
Yeah. I mean, Smith, they charge me what they call a scanning fee. And I don't remember what it was. I think it was something like $25 a picture, which isn't super cheap if you have like 10 pictures or 12, and sometimes the publisher will pay for it or part of it. The horror story that I have is, I've told the classes when I, wrote the book on the person who wrote the Hardy Boys book with, they're written in the 20s and 30s. Let's put the first three Hardy Boy book covers in the book, right? Because, you know, they've got the Hardy Boys looking like people from the 30s, you know? And so that was pretty interesting and funny. So Simon and Schuster now owns, or they did when I wrote the book, they didn't when back in the 30s, but they now own the Hardy Boys books, or they did. So we go, can we have permission to run the first three covers? And I don't remember exactly the amount, but it was something like, sure, for $500 a piece, you can run the first, we'll give you permission. I'm like, whoa, you know, $500. And I don't know if it was $500 or $400 or what. And then my publisher said, well, tell them we're a nonprofit, you know. Yeah, well, that got like, you know, $50 off a book. It didn't do a lot. So they ended up running the first Hardy Boys book, you know, and so that's unfortunate, you know, but you're right. It's an example of what you just said. Simon and Schuster apparently is not going to say, all right, you know, here for $20 a piece, we'll give you the permission. You know, that's not going to happen.
Sure. Another part of selling the book, the marketability, is finding someone to write the foreword. Yeah. And I want to ask you about that, because you want to have someone who has some cachet, someone who's obviously going to be easy to work with, who's not going to maybe charge you because they're lending their name to this book. And for your book on Pauline Frederick, you were able to get Marlene Sanders, a television news correspondent who had worked for ABC in the 60s and the 70s and moved to CBS in 1978. And she is known as a pioneer in the field, the first woman to anchor an evening news broadcast for a major network. She did so for ABC in 1964, and the first woman to report on the Vietnam War from the field. So how do you go about identifying a good forward writer, first of all, and then how do you try to contact them?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, just interesting fact, Marlene Sanders is Jeffrey Toobin's mother, you know, the person who's on CNN.
Right. Interesting. Yes.
Anyway, I got her because, you know, she came after Pauline, but Pauline was still around. In other words, when Pauline was a seasoned correspondent, Marlene was one of a few young up and comers who are just starting in network news. So she knew her a little bit, you know. And so I go to, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I have her contact. I'm going to interview her. And I interviewed her. It was a phone interview, and it was pretty interesting. And I was telling, actually, it was Joe Burnt, the same person who's, you know, sent me the article on Pauline. And I said, oh, she was pretty interesting. And, you know, she said this and that. And he said, oh, you should get her to write the foreword, you know. And I was like, whoa, eureka. You know, what a good idea. For some reason, I hadn't thought of it. I mean, this was in the middle of it, and I didn't have to do it yet. But I kind of put that in the back of my mind. And in her case, she knew her. You know, she worked in the same environment that she did. She you know, knew what it was like to work back then. She was, you know, easy to talk to. She you know, was a nice person. And she felt that more people should know about the plight of these women pioneers in broadcasting. So she felt in a way, you know, hey, I want people to know about Pauline. So yeah, you know, you want somebody who's an authority. Ideally, I don't know. It just depends on your subject. I like it when the person who writes the foreword either knows the person's work or knows the person. Liz Smith, the gossip columnist, wrote the foreword to my Charlotte Curtis book. And again, she knew Charlotte. And it was a similar situation. Charlotte was a seasoned reporter when Liz was kind of just, I don't want to say just starting out, but Charlotte knew the ropes, I guess, when Liz first came to New York. She was from Texas. And Charlotte helped her. And so she really liked her. You know, she really helped her out. And so she I called her, I you know, it was easier to get people's phone numbers back then before the internet and privacy. But I ended up calling her and she said she'd do it. And she was a lovely, lovely person. My publisher said, you know, you can tell her we'll give her a small honorarium, you know, whatever that means, you know, $100, $200. And Liz was active in literacy. She was active in literacy. She very much literacy movements. And so she said, oh, yeah, I'll take it and I'll give it to this literacy charity that I like. So, and that was very nice, you know. So, you know, they write, people like that don't write the forwards for the money, you know, and she took it for the, you know, for the charity. But I was very lucky in both those cases because they knew the person, they knew the era, and they were willing to do it. You know, when you're, you know, writing about writers, writers know other writers. And so it makes it a lot easier because, you know, those people are pretty articulate. So, yeah, I know we have discussed, you know, forwards and how important they are. And sometimes it's difficult to get somebody.
And in addition to getting people to write the foreword, you have to find somebody to write blurbs that would be in the back of the book or in a press release.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're cannibalizing people who write a blurb because you pick them for the foreword. But the same sort of idea there of one strategy might be, well, I'll have other people who have written books for the same publisher and proven that they're successful. They know what good research is. Sometimes you want people who are just going to sell to the common person. And your books are such that although they may have an academic audience and they certainly have the academic rigor to the method and everything, they are intended for anybody who might just be interested in the history of TV news or a good story. So you might want someone like a Liz Smith or a Marlene Sanders who is just well known to the common person. So when you're trying to get the blurbs, any specific strategy you do to get that?
Oh, now blurbs, you know, blurbs can be a pain in the neck, you know, for the reasons you mentioned. The blurbs, I kind of start worrying about near the end of the process. They're like, you know, you think about them like you do the cover. I'm at a point now where I start thinking about them early on because I'm, you know, seasoned to do that. But I don't, you know, those I try to worry about more at the end. Sometimes the publisher will help you, you know, get a blurb or they'll come up with a blurb. That kind of thing. And at the Ohio University Press, they were pretty good about that. They had ideas. And in fact, they even, you know, contacted some people, which I think is unusual. But you have to make sure that you're the one responsible for the blurb. I mean, if your publisher does it, you're pretty lucky, you know, or if they help you, you're pretty lucky. But be thinking about it kind of right from the start. Sometimes somebody, you know, as you were saying, somebody who's interested in the topic, somebody who's a known name, you know, in the field. Obviously, any name recognition is wonderful, and, you know, publishers love that.
Well, and then just to start wrapping up and to think about Pauline Frederick and her impact, bringing this to the modern day, I'm wondering if you see any parallels between some of the struggles that Pauline may have gone through, being a woman in a male-dominated industry, being a pioneer, to what we see going on today with a lot of the female news correspondents, especially those covering President Trump in the White House. He's obviously tangled with many reporters, male and female, but there have been particular instances where he seems to interact with women in a different way. And for example, in October, he was criticized for telling one female reporter from Pauline's alma mater, ABC News, Cecilia Vega, that I know you're not thinking, you never do. And in November, he told another female reporter, Abby Phillip from CNN, quote, what a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions, end quote. So you're seeing this kind of bullying adversarial relationship between the president and female correspondents. Do you see any links to what Pauline went through? And you said you had looked at just what female correspondents of that era, Marlene Sanders, Barbara Walters, whoever else, might have dealt with male subjects, including politicians. So any parallels there to what happened with Pauline and what's happening now?
Well, I'll tell you one big parallel is not necessarily what you mentioned, but the business about women correspondents having to look good and having their hair to be perfect. And, you know, they have to be camera ready, even if it's, you know, 5 a.m. Way back when Pauline first went into broadcasting, and that was in the late 40s. Because she'd been a print person, then a radio person, and then TV. She wrote about it, you know, in interviews back in the 50s, in magazine interviews. She said, you know, the men, all they have to do is, you know, put on a suit and tie, and their hair has to be neat, and they're good to go. She, you know, she said, my hair has to be perfect. Then they wanted her to lighten her hair, which I think she did. You know, she said, my hair is really much darker than this, and if it were up to me, it would be dark. They had her wear contact lenses, I think, for a while, which she wasn't crazy about. So, and as she got older and was giving talks, you know, to women broadcasters, she even said, you know, this focus on looks, you know, you have to be beautiful. You have to be beautiful. She said, you know, if someone's, you know, presentable, what's wrong with that? And she really did feel that women face that more than men, that they weren't going to get very far in broadcasting. You know, a woman wasn't unless she was, you know, attractive. I mean, I'm not saying she has to be stunning, but she felt she had to be attractive, you know, as she got older, she felt that same way. So that's a parallel. Now, one of Pauline's kind of one thing she always said in speeches too was, you know, you really have to know what you're doing. You have to be up on the subject, and I you know, there's no way. I don't think that would help in this era of Donald Trump and female broadcasters. I mean, because these women are very smart and they know, you know, the topic they cover. But one anecdote, as far as Pauline, she was really, you know, the dean of the United Nations reporters. She was, you know, knew everything there was to know about the United Nations. And one of the pictures I found out in the archive was, it was a picture of Pauline interviewing George Bush the first. You know, the first president, George Bush. He wasn't president. He'd just been named, I think, to the, you know, ambassador of the United Nations, which was a prestigious post. And he signed the picture, and on the back, it was the front, I guess, it said, and I'll never forget this, it was a great picture. It said, to Pauline, I hope one day I know as much about the United Nations as you do. And I thought, wow, that is a real gracious thing to write. A, it's gracious, and B, it speaks to her reputation. You know, you've got this guy who's going to be the, you know, ambassador, and he's saying, boy, you know so much more than anybody else. So, again, I don't think it would help in this era of Trump, because he doesn't really care how much you know. But you know, this is what makes the job so difficult. You're not only in front of the camera, you have to know so much, and you have to do so much of your homework. You know, when you're not in front of the camera. So it's a tough job. It's a tough job now. I don't know if it's any tougher than it was when there were only three networks. Who knows? But she was, I'll tell you, Pauline did not work 8-hour days. You know, they were much, much longer than that. And you know, and it just is probably worse today.
Well, this has been great to talk about Pauline and all these biographies that you've written. I wonder if we can just end with a question that we ask a lot of our guests here. Very simply, and you can take it in any direction you want, why does journalism history matter? You devoted your life to doing this sort of research. Why do you think it matters to tell these sorts of stories?
Oh, I mean, it really does shape the way you think about the present and the future. I mean, if this Trump era is teaching us anything, and maybe this is something good to come of it. It's like, it really shows you, hey, if you do this now, this is what can happen later. You know, are you this one small step? It seems like it's nothing now. But if you look at history, 3 steps from now, it could lead to something good or bad. You know, I mean, and I'm not just saying that in a negative way. you know, you have to put the present in context. I mean, you can't just live the present. You know, I know what happened now and I know what happened 6 months ago, because I think it really does shape the future, shape the way you think, shape the way you act. So I think it's absolutely vital. You know, it really is. I mean, it's not just a luxury.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Greenwald. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much. Just for the listeners, Dr. Greenwald was my dissertation director at Ohio University. And in 2016, I defended my dissertation that was called We Want Fish Sticks, bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. It was about the hockey team that I grew up rooting for on Long Island. And in 1995, they changed their logo from this traditional depiction of the letters NY and a map of Long Island to be this fisherman who looked a lot like the Gorton's fisherman from the fish stick box. And I ended up getting a book contract from the University of Nebraska Press, which is the same publisher that published your Pauline Frederick book. Right. So that was a nice connection, and that's coming out right now. So yeah. I appreciate all of your guidance on that project. I certainly learned a lot about how to do biography and this sort of writing in your course. So thank you.
Thank you. And thanks. I appreciate it. I enjoyed talking about what I do.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Journalism History Podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Nick Hershon, signing off with the words of Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.